Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we're sharing author interviews for our summer Goodreads Hanaho show. We pause to think about the time space we're in from a Zen and Indigenous point of view. When none of the things around us seem to work, what do we do? Ever wonder what it's like to read other people's minds? We talk to an author of a young adult novel with a character who can do just that. An award-winning Maui illustrator writes her first picture book, A Lesson for Keiki, about self-empowerment. And we look back into history with a book highlighting the golden age of swimming and the Paris Olympics Kings of the Water. Go ahead and curl up in your favorite spot, and you might find a new title to add to your book bag. It's Friday, August 29th. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's our Summer Goodreads Hanaho show, and we start with a book that was first published on Election Day. It wasn't planned that way, but that was how the stars aligned, and the audiobook was just released following intense reflection of President Donald Trump's first 100 days in office. The book's title is When No Thing Works, A Zen and Indigenous Perspective on Resilience and Leadership in the Time-Space of Collapse. We talk with author and Zen master, Norma Wong.
My assessment of what's been happening over the last few years is that it's been increasingly more difficult for things to become resolved or for problems to be dealt with or institutions to be able to work. And that would have been the case irrespective of what the outcome of the election was. It just turns out that the results and everything that's happened since then has punctuated this notion of a country and really the world at being at such polarized odds with each other that we really are incapable of coming to the types of big decisions that we ought to. And so therefore, we fight.
Well, when you think about the turmoil and people are starting to wonder, well, who are our allies and who are our enemies? You really need to center yourself and calm yourself down when there is so much chaos. I think of the president's inauguration day and at the service, the spiritual leader that was there presiding had asked for mercy. Then when you see just what has happened, you know, since then, that people need something. People need help in navigating through this time.
You know, I think that we're in a really tight spot. Many people feel the world as a threatening thing right now. And when that happens, there is one instinct among many to take care of ourselves only, rather than the notion that we're all in it together. Growing up in Hawaii, this is a place, the island mentality essentially, right, is that we may be of many peoples and we may have different interests. But when it comes down to it, we have to take care of each other because we are alone here, right, in the middle of the Pacific. And the individualistic nature of the United States doesn't help that very much. So here we are, and we're in a tight binary where the success of any given moment is counted in small numbers of votes or small numbers of people speaking up in a particular way or small numbers of wins that quickly disappear. And the whole notion of this book is we cannot continue in this way. Not only the world's counting on it, our descendants are counting on us, not continuing in this way.
In your book, you talk about the lens that people have to view the world.
A lens is something that we see the world through because of how we were brought up or the cultures that we are a part of, the things that have happened in the world while we were in it. So, you know, the babies that were born during the pandemic, for example, will grow up to see the world differently. Particularly the teenagers during the pandemic will end up seeing the world differently. So there's this part where we are colored by our lens. And we need to understand that other people have different lenses in which they see the world and not just fight all of our fights right through that lens. A perspective that I was positing in the book is that there are peoples and places like Hawaii where because we have the gift of many lenses, because there are many peoples who live in close quarters with each other, who come from different backgrounds, that we see the world in a more complex way than might occur in other places. Not quite as black and white, you or me, you know, all or nothing. We seek a different way of resolution of things. And that would be something that we think of as island way, but I also think of that as being very, very indigenous in its perspective. You know, all indigenous peoples, wherever it is they may live in the world, right, have this notion that people have to be able to be in relationship with each other to take care of the many needs of the peoples. It's a more collective notion. And then from a Zen perspective, that you don't live in the world alone. Among other things, humans aren't the only beings. And so, you know, therefore, a more interdependent way of being is something that we badly need.
So it's the Zen lens.
You could say that.
You know, growing up and living here in Hawaii, you don't think of diversity and inclusiveness as a program.
That's correct. And I think that therein lies the strength of it, if it's not a program. When it's a program and it's prescribed and people feel like they have to behave a particular way because of rules, those rules could be something they either embrace or they could rebel against. And right now, we're in definitely a rebel against particular place. And it comes from scarcity. It comes from the notion that somehow some people's success will come at the expense of other people's, rather than this notion that we need to have the contributions of many people's in order to figure things out. Right. Many peoples have something to offer, not only the labors, but the wisdom and the knowledge of many peoples. And this is something that is sadly at a de minimis in this country right now, the country called the United States. I'd say that there's a lot of rebooting that will have to occur if we are going to see it to the other side.
Getting back to your title, it's When No Thing Works. Why is it that versus when nothing works?
Because I don't think it's true that nothing is working. I think that every day people still wake up, that they have family, that they love each other. I think that some phenomenal things are still occurring in the world. So I don't think it's true that nothing is working. But the constructs of things, government isn't working right now. Government is struggling. Even in places where we have good-hearted leadership, that all of the institutions, the containers that we built, are struggling mightily. Even in places where we have good-hearted leadership, values-led leadership, the institutions of places are struggling to keep up with the many needs. The world right now is struggling. The world in terms of the climate changes that are occurring, you know, these vast differences that are occurring with respect to the weather means that there are places where people can no longer live. And so out of desperation, they migrate. And the migration is occurring beyond the capacity of all of the constructs of institutions that were built to manage those types of things, right? So human behaviors are overflowing, and all the things that we built in order to manage human behaviors are having a hard time. So that's what I meant when I said no thing. The things are not working.
And so what do you hope that people will take away from this book?
Because of the extraordinary crisis that is occurring everywhere, within that is the opportunity for really big shifts to occur. Right? So it's only in crisis do things get dire enough that we're jarred away from our sense of stability and we move towards bigger changes, as in how we might treat each other, what it is that we may need to do for the future, so that we actually have a place for our descendants. I hope that they adopt a longer view than the short views of changes that we're looking at today. So an Indigenous perspective, a Kanaka perspective, is that you are doing the work in this time for many generations to come. And in the many generations ahead, everything is less tight, right? It's more possible. Bigger things can be taken care of. In the moment, we could argue about something like food security, and we can argue about the policies of that, or X, Y, or Z. Or we could say, you know what, Hawaii may soon, as in within a few decades, be in a situation where we're going to have much more sustainability than we have now. So let's just go about doing the really big things, not the small manini things, that would make sure that we're growing enough food for each other, that we are managing our waste differently, that we are in many, many hundreds and thousands of small enterprises, not dependent on a few large enterprises that would be more dependent upon what happens globally. And not as a way of isolating ourselves from the world, but understanding that all places are probably going to need to do this, become more interdependent on a small scale, and then in relationship with other places to cause a wider web of understanding and of a new kind of economy. So these big shifts are more difficult when there isn't chaos. You know, that's a paradox. But when things are chaotic, as they are right now, well, why not? Why not? If you're going to take a gamble, do you take a gamble on passing a new policy, or do you take a gamble on planting our own food? I take the gamble on planting our own food.
I'm a big fan of resilience. And if there's anything that I can pass on to my grandchild, I hope it's that concept of being resilient.
Yes, you know, Lili'uokalani's version of resilience is the one that I hope we remember and that we adopt, right? Which is, she was a leader during a really hard time. And her notion is that if her people, you know, if our ancestors didn't work for our own thriving, then it wouldn't matter if someday we got back our governance. So how would we know what thriving would look like? That we could take care of each other, could feed each other, that we could sing, that we would remember the stories, that we could have enough happiness within us, that we would bring children into the world and that we would care for them. And this notion that thriving, which is different than just a resilience of survival, it's the way that you win against those who would hope that you are no longer here.
That was a rebroadcast of our interview with Zen master and author Norma Wong, who sat down with us this past May to talk about her new book, When No Thing Works. It's available locally at Arts and Letters online and is also available as an audiobook. Wish you could read other people's minds? Well, you're not alone. It's the superpower of the Center of a Nene Award-nominated young adult novel called Clairvoyance, a play on the main character's name and her ability to peer inside the minds of the boys at school. The conversation's D.W. Gibson sat down with the novel's author, Christiana Kahakavila, to talk about what the story has to say about learning to listen to yourself and others. She starts by explaining the mashup of words that make up the title of the book.
Clara is the main character. She just started sixth grade, and her best friend she's on the outs with, his name is Leo, and she wishes that she could just know what boys were thinking. And so she ends up having voyance. She is clairvoyant for what boys are thinking, and it is going to help her navigate friendships and make some new ones.
Or so she thinks.
There are some missteps along the way.
Which seems to be what happens when people gain access to other individuals' internal thoughts in cinema and literature. It doesn't ever quite go as people plan. What do you think it is that's so tempting, let's say, about this superpower that's so irresistible for humans?
I think it's that we think if we only had all the information, then we'd know how to handle the problem. And maybe Clara, not unlike her author, thinks that if she could just have all the information, she could logic it out. Like, we can just think our way through it. But, you know, life is so much more complicated and humans are so much more complicated. And it's about feeling and it's about listening. It's hugely about listening and about connecting. So, yeah, it's about more than thinking.
Yeah, I had a note about listening, which I want to come back to. But the other thing that strikes me about the sort of desire to tap into other people's thoughts is some desire to control, some desire to have control, right? More control in our lives to maybe fix the past or shape the future.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we all wish we could probably control more than we can. But I think especially in middle school, you know, kids are coming out of elementary where maybe they're slightly more comfortable with parents controlling things. They're moving into a space where they want to be closer to the adult world. They want to have more control over their lives. I mean, so much of Clara figuring out her life is just dependent on if an adult can drive her somewhere. And and that sense of being out of control, it's just so real for kids that age.
Great point. As someone who spends a lot of time driving around a tween, looking at it from the other angle, I think that you're right. That sense of, I want to get from A to B, and even that can't happen without intervention. Yeah. So that sort of supercharges that desire to gain more control in your life.
Yeah. And in middle school, I like to joke, I'm the only person who had a good middle school experience. And even having a good one, I think that feeling of feeling like you're the only one. I'm the only one who did something ridiculous at lunch. I'm the only one who's having problems with my friends. And that can feel out of control too. So one of the big parts of the story is Clara making new friends and reconnecting with the different kid characters in the book, understanding they're not alone and what they're going through.
You mentioned listening, and I'm glad you did, because that did really stand out to me as perhaps even a central theme of the book. In a lot of ways, I felt like it was a book about listening, who we listen to, how do we listen to others, how do we listen to ourselves? It seems like a good thing to explore in a world that's increasingly noisy, with everyone just sort of shouting across social media. And middle school is often the time when kids wrestle with, or parents, we should say, wrestle with the opportunity to enter the social media world. Talk a little bit more about listening and why it's so important.
Yes. Well, so Clara's best friend's name is Leo, which is short for Kaleo, the voice, and he happens to be a very talented singer. So there are these little hints in the book, characters' names and other moments, that this is a book about learning to speak, which Clara needs to do, but also, yes, learning to listen and really hear where other people are at and not make assumptions. You know, so much of the social media landscape is also making assumptions about people or wanting certain assumptions made. If we think about the photos we put on Instagram, wanting the assumption to be made that everything's fine. And getting behind that mask and really listening is, I think, is just an important and heartfelt thing we can do in life.
Yeah, I think assumptions are sort of, in some ways, feel like the antithesis of listening. And breaking past assumptions absolutely is at the heart of getting to what someone is trying to actually communicate to the world. Talk about the device for channeling the inner voice in the book. I think it's an interesting choice you made.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, Clara can hear what boys are thinking. And then the trick to writing any story is also understanding what the limits are of it. So I wanted a device so she could begin this journey back to understanding, listening to, and connecting with her ex-best friend, Leo. But Claire's also in a hard spot with her dad. He's gotten a great job in Arizona. She thinks she wants to leave the islands. She's figuring out what home is. And at the same time, I wanted her gift to be sort of limited to just kids her age for a variety of reasons. So actually, she has to start to learn to listen to her dad and other adults without her gift. And so often, and I think the best kids book, the gift is a way of opening up some skill that we need in real life.
Yeah, that makes sense. You use Alolo Hawaii throughout the book. It certainly isn't composed entirely in Alolo Hawaii, but it plays a big part in the text. Talk about your approach there to making that a part of the reading experience.
Yes, so I use Alolo Hawaii, and I also use Moments of Pigeon. Both of those choices were important to me because that's what I heard growing up here, and it's what I hear now still. So it just felt part of, if I'm going to write Hawaii as I do, then I need to write its languages. Another part of it is that middle schoolers and late elementary, they're so brilliant and they pick up on language. And when they're reading, they're learning new words in English, and they're actually incredibly savvy at picking up cues. So all the Olelo Hawaii I use has some cues around it as to what it probably means, but I don't use any translations. And I have to say, the amazing and beautiful fan letters I get, the kids have no problem, whether they live here in Hawaii or they live in Boston. They have no problem with the Olelo or the pidgin. And I think it actually speaks to what flexible minds they have.
And it's a good way to create active readers, right? To engage the text and be more active in that experience of reading the book.
Yes, exactly. And I laugh at myself. I use the word cacophony at one point, which I feel is an absurdly large word. But again, I kind of like build out some hints as to what it probably means. And yeah, the young readers are picking up English as well.
Kids are good at guessing. They are. And I support cacophony there. That has sort of an onomatopoeic quality
it does,
to it.
It does.
Can catch the drift. Yeah. You mentioned Clara's dad moving to Arizona and themes of questions about home and thinking about home. And I feel like geography is another thing that plays an important part in the story. Clara spent years moving around a military family. Her friend, Pua, that she makes, also grew up on the continent. Talk about how these split experiences on the continent and in Hawaii inform how these characters see the world.
Yes, I mean, I grew up in California. I grew up in Long Beach, California. My dad's from Maui. I was fortunate to spend a ton of time on Maui growing up. But I've always felt, you know, I grew up in the diaspora. I wanted to come back, and it was also difficult to come back. There are financial reasons for that. There are reasons of just relationships and jobs and other things that happen for adults. And I wanted a book that would reflect that honestly, the desire to come home, but also the desire to leave because something is probably actually going to be a little easier on the continent. So yeah, Pua's just moved back with her family from Seattle, and she's trying to figure out what it means to be here. And then, at least for a good portion of the book, Clara is really desperate to get off island. She thinks it's going to solve all her problems, and that's sort of her dream. And so figuring out what home is and who it is a big part of the journey.
What does she discover about those questions?
What are some of the places
she arrives at as she wrestles with those questions?
I think a big part is that, so she lives with her tutu up on North Shore, up on the hillside above the Pupukea foodland.
Nice.
And her tutu has lo'i. And so she's really understanding a relationship with place that's very specific and also very active. Like, she really knows what it means to Malama Aina, that is part of their daily life. So her relationships are not just with humans, they're with more than humans, and they're with the land, and they're with the lo'i. And so part of her journey is discovering, yeah, what it means to have these really active relationships and intimacies with place.
I also like that Clara and Pua have sort of these, not conflicting, but they're coming from very different angles that you described. And I think that that helps them sort of inform each other and help each other grow.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And they're both understanding what place is in different ways. Pua's mom happens to be a scientist, so they're studying streams. They get a watershed or ahupua'a project from one of their teachers. So we're seeing all the kids kind of navigate what place means and what we can learn from it.
One thing that caught my eye is that you more or less begin the book with a mention of Iz's cover of Country Road, and you end there as well. Any significance there or any point of origin there in terms of how that song came to play a prominent role in the book?
It's a song I've always loved, so that was point one.
Good point.
Yeah. It's also a song that names places, which I think is important because the places here are very specific and they're named. And then, yeah, it names Mount Ka'ala, and that has a role in the book. So I played that song nonstop while I was drafting the book.
So that's the title track for the soundtrack
for
the book.
It is.
Did your own process of moving back to Hawaii, as you've detailed, is very difficult in many ways. Did that personal experience inform how you were thinking about these themes of home and geography and belonging?
It definitely did. I moved back as an adult in, 2007. And I have been off and on island since then. And then I had a job in Washington State starting in 2012. So when I got the offer from UH Manoa to come here in 2020, it really did feel life-changing. It was something I had wanted to do, my spouse and I were committed to doing. And yeah, so I do have like a lot of the feelings that the kids have of what does it mean to move off island, what opportunities might be there, what jobs, but also what kind of commitments do you make to this place and in your family and your ohana and in the people who make this place yours.
Yeah, one can think about returning home in big, grandiose ways, right, in terms of identity and belonging and big words like that. But as you just detailed, it often boils down to pragmatics, right? Logistics, job, housing, these day-to-day realities.
Yes, and I think a lot about how Kanaka Maoli are the largest population who move off island, and they do so, you know, sometimes with heartbreaking reasons and sometimes with logistically smart reasons. But to be able to come home was one of my biggest goals. And I think it's something it just means a lot to me. And so I wanted my young characters to be able to do that. And then again, also, like, there's a point when Clara decides she does want to be here and she wants to stay with her tutu. Like, she has to have that talk with her dad. And of course, kids aren't always in control of these decisions. But I think being able to at least imagine a situation where a child can express what she feels and have this deep conversation with the parent she trusts most felt like something I wanted to put into the world.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson and novelist Christiana Kahakavila about her latest book, Clairvoyance, which is a 2025 Asian Pacific American Libraries Association honor book.
This is Dana. I'm with the membership department, and I'm currently reading John Grisham's Camino Ghosts. It's a third in a series about Camino Island off the coast of Florida, and it has to do with the publishing world and mysteries, and I'm enjoying it. It's a light read. It's kind of a fun summer read, and I read the other two and enjoyed them too.
My name is Mia Yoshimoto. I am short-timer executive assistant. This is my last week, but I will stay very close to the station. I say if you have to read a book that you'd want to read this summer, read Stargirl by Jerry Spinelli. It's a beautiful book on really discovering who you are and letting your creative self thrive, because that will make other people around you thrive as well.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Ohana Ho with some of our favorite authors. Next up, a keiki picture book described as a modern fable, illustrated and written by a Maui resident. Layla and the Voice transports readers into Layla's world, where fear looms dark and overwhelming. With the help of a supernatural creature called the Voice, the youngster learns to make friends with her monsters and stand tall before her fears. The Conversations with Lillian Song sat down with award-winning illustrator Sherazad Medani to talk about what it was like writing her first children's book.
I'm in Kihei. I know a lot of people, they think it's like way too hot and dry, but that's like my best climate. I love it. I grew up when I was very little, I was in the desert, so I love Kihei.
Which desert were you in?
The Sahara. I grew up in Niger and in Kenya. And so up until I was about 5, I lived in Niger. And so that's like my baseline. It's nice hot weather. I was living in Niamey, which is the capital. But if you look at my work, I think that there's probably a lot of hints of having grown up in Kenya. There was a lot of wildlife and it was just a part of my childhood. So Maui, the temperature is a lot like Kenya. So it can be, you know, you can go up country and it's nice and cold. And then there's certain areas in Kenya, like down at the coast, which is a lot like Kihei. But Kenya's sort of a little bit more the in-between temperature-wise. And I mean, a lot of the plants that you see in Maui, it's a lot like Kenya. So I feel kind of, there's a connection there. I felt very at home when I first moved.
You know, I'm just really fascinated by creatives. How is that process? What's going to go into the book?
It's very interesting as an illustrator to be a creative and have, you know, you have deadlines. So there's on some level an element of waiting for the right idea to come or waiting for the perfect thing. And then on another, you just have to do it. So there have been so many times where I get an idea and I think it's perfect. And then, you know, it goes through the sketch phase and the editing. And then I see, I'm like, oh, that doesn't actually work very well. And then I have to come up with another idea and I have a deadline. So I got to just make it work. You know, if you have all the time in the world to make a piece, there isn't this sort of pressure to like come up with an idea and do it on a specific timeline. So it's really a very interesting thing to come up with an idea that you think is good when there is sort of like a crunch time around it. And so I find that being an illustrator is a little bit different to being a fine artist because, you know, you can't just wait until the idea comes to you. You have to keep working. And sometimes it's not your best, but you can tweak it and it can become something amazing. It's definitely something that was kind of an adjustment for me at the beginning when I started because I couldn't just wait and say, no, I don't have the right idea yet. People who are around me during deadline times, they know that they'll see me a bit stressed out. My children, actually, they've been hearing the word deadline their whole life and they didn't know what it meant, but they thought I was saying dead lion. And so it's a funny joke in my house now that whenever I have a deadline, they would hang a deadline toy on the door to be like, Mommy's in deadline time.
That is just the most adorable family story. And how old are your Kiki?
My eldest is 10 and then the younger is 8.
Well, you are a seasoned award-winning illustrator, many titles under your belt. Layla and the Voice, this is actually your author illustrator debut. What moved you into that lane?
So when I first started illustrating picture books, I just have such a love for reading and I love telling stories. And so I started writing pretty soon. Like I didn't wait. So I was illustrating books and writing at the same time. And I would send these dummies, these manuscripts to my agent, Kirsten Hall, who's amazing, by the way. And she was so gracious with me and she would tell me, you know, work on it some more. And she would be really patient with me about getting better at writing. And eventually I was, you know, I had decided to give it a break for a bit because I was working on another book, illustrating it. And I was reading a story by, she's a great illustrator, Oge Mora. And I was reading it to my daughter. It's called Saturday. And I think it's just it's one of my favorite picture books. It's just a story about a little girl with her mother and, you know, what they do in a day. And I remember reading it and then, you know, thinking, God, I really wish I could write a book that's like this, that feels like this book. But then I realized that I was like, well, it wasn't really my experience to have that in my life. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go about writing a book that feels more true to what I felt when I was little. And so it didn't take me very long. And I sent the first manuscript off to Kirsten and she helped me kind of like tweak it a bit, but it was a pretty fast process.
What was that feeling that you were trying to capture?
Well, when I was little, if I had known that other children were feeling the same thing that I felt, so feeling maybe at home that something scary was happening or something didn't feel right, I want kids to have that experience when they're home to have something to go, oh, I'm not alone. And I can access something greater than myself or that is great within me. And so that's kind of why I wrote the book. I wanted to have a space for kids who, you know, they're capable of handling deep, hard topics. And people like to sometimes think that picture books are just about, you know, like going to the park or having a cozy time with the family. And that's very much a part of childhood, but it's not all encompassing. Kids experience pain just like adults experience it. So I wanted a book to show a little girl who struggles and comes out of it on the other end knowing herself.
And so for our listeners, why don't you just give us a really quick synopsis?
Yeah. So the story starts with this figure that appears and it's called the Mad Cloud. And Layla, she is afraid of it because it's sort of looming over her. She runs away and it basically takes her into this dreary, scary jungle. And she's lost in this jungle until all of a sudden she hears a voice and she uncovers this voice. The story is about Layla and this voice learning to basically trust each other. And ultimately, in the end, Layla learns that she can trust herself. This voice is within her. And it's really about self-empowerment and hearing your own inner wisdom.
Those are very good lessons to take away. And this is a book that, you know, you can revisit again and again because there's always something new to discover. I love how words move visually with the fonts, the colors, the size.
Oh, yeah. The editors, Jasmine and Sydney that I work with, they were so great. When I saw the final book, the way that they put the words that sort of like go curve round on the serpent, I thought it was just such a great detail that they added.
And the artwork itself, where there are some pages where the background is very muted, others, though, where the textures come through and you have so many fine details. What was that style of art?
It was actually sort of really serendipitous the way that that came about. Sometimes I would send my agent, Kirsten, mock covers of books that I wanted to do. And I had done, this was actually like, do you know that scratch art that we all had when we were little? It's this crayon scratch art where you would put crayon down and then you put black crayon on top and you scratch away. So I had done that on a piece. And thankfully, my agent was like, oh, this is amazing. You really need to like do more work with this kind of artwork. And so when I wrote Layla, it seemed perfect to put these two things together because the whole book is about this girl uncovering her own inner voice. And scratch art is all about scratching away a layer so you can see the light underneath. I had a lot of fun with it. So it was really kind of meditative to sit. And I made the scratch art myself. So I would do an underlayer of chalk pastel. And that in and of itself was like, I loved the drawings, these paintings underneath, basically. I loved them. And then I would have to cover them completely with huge chunks of this dark crayon and then scratch away. And it was messy, but I really enjoyed it. It's like very different from the work that I've done before. It's much darker. I usually do chalk pastel and watercolor. This is the first time I've done crayon.
The cover actually is very rainbow-esque to me. And would you say that Hawaii had any influence on your style?
Yeah, very much so. I think I started writing in 2020 and, you know, the time frame for picture books can be years because you start on the book and by the time that it gets bought, you're working on another book and you have to pace it so that you have enough time to work on it. But I finished the final art in Maui and definitely with the colors, everything that I'm surrounded by, especially nature, is such a huge part of what I like to create. Like it's something that I will doodle instinctively is, you know, plants. And if you look at my work, I always have some kind of floral aspect. I definitely was very much influenced by what I see in Maui.
And the stylization, very unique on the voice. What was that design?
Yeah, that's very much influenced from growing up in Kenya, also Niger. The mask, there's a mask on the end of the book. I had it sort of hidden. This is like a little tidbit for people who want to find it in the book. Yeah, it's actually like copied from one that I grew up with. It's in my house right now. And so all of the designs are sort of picked up from things I grew up with in Kenya. And I did a lot of research too, where of looking at tribal patterns and animal symbolism, because it was just something that was such a big part of my upbringing that I thought it would be, it's just perfect to sort of intertwine it in the book.
And as we look forward, you are going to be sharing your book with the rest of the world. Tell me about that.
It's exciting. I mean, it's funny. As an illustrator, I haven't actually been in the publicity realm. I've been working steadily since for years, but I've been fortunate enough to have writers who I've worked with that they kind of take that on and they go to conferences and they do signings and stuff. This will be my first time actually of doing publicity for books. So with Layla, I'm sure there's going to be more things that I get to speak about the book, and I'm just excited, just happy that I got to sort of offer this. You know, my goal is just to be able to give something that if one kid sees this book and feels seen, then I would have done my job. I care really that it's helping the kid that needs to read it. And if someone finds it at the library, they can take it home and they can feel empowered and like they have something for themselves.
That was Maui-based artist Sherazad Medani and HBR's Lillian Song. Medani dedicates Layla and the Voice to her twin sister, the namesake of the main character. Her book just came out earlier this summer. You can find the title at your local bookstore or online at Penguin Random House. Thank you.
I'm Bill Dorm, and I work in the news department at Hawaii Public Radio. A book that I finished recently that I enjoyed a lot was The Wide, Wide Sea, about Captain James Cook's ultimately final voyage to Hawaii, but a lot about matching not only the voluminous records that the British Navy keeps of various things, but oral histories of indigenous peoples in various regions, not just in Hawaii, but in Alaska, elsewhere in the Pacific. And it's a compelling look, well-researched, and brings new perspective, I think, to a very important point, certainly in Hawaiian history, but also adds a bit of a human story about Cook himself and gives some context to it.
My name is Kelsey, board operator here at HPR. And right now, my summer reading recommendation is called The Lucky Ones by Zara Chaudhary. And I actually heard about this book on Here and Now while I was working. I read an excerpt about it after hearing her interview on the radio, and the excerpt was so good that I had to go to Barnes & Noble's and pick up a copy.
Welcome back to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We just celebrated Duke Kahanamoku's birthday this past weekend, so we thought it fitting to share a conversation that we had with Todd Balfe, whose book, Three Kings, pays homage to the golden age of swimming. It was after going through a rare bout of spinal cancer and losing the use of his legs that pushed Balfe into the water. It was there he discovered a love for swimming and its history. Balfe says he came across a story about the opening of the Waikiki Natatorium. The anticipation was high as Hawaii's son, Duke Kahanamoku, was there to compete with two of his rivals. Balfe sets the stage.
6,000 people are in the stands and in the trees, and there's a traffic jam all over Honolulu. It was just exciting to read about it. And, you know, the draw was Duke Kahanamoku was returning to Hawaii to open up the pool, and his rivals were there, two of whom were Johnny Weissmuller and Katsu Takeishi, and both of whom he swam against in the 1924 Olympics in Paris. And that was, the more I read into that race, the more I wanted to know how they got to Paris in 1924. So really, that opened the door to the origins of each swimmer's culture, the background, and the path that they took. Very, very different, but really interesting to contrast those different paths as they got to Paris in 1924.
And you talk about race and class and how they really had to navigate, you know, a different battle outside of the water.
Yeah. I think that recently Charles Barkley, the basketball player, was remarking on Willie Mays and what he had to endure. This was just after Willie Mays had passed away. And Willie Mays, we have no idea what those people like Willie Mays, like all the pioneers of color, had to go through just to play their sports. They're the true heroes. And that really goes for Duke and what he had to endure and his willingness to put it out there, to go to the mainland to swim against rivals who really were people wanted to see him fail, which he didn't. And I think Duke's personality was such that he minimized some of the trials that he went through to get to the world stage as he did. But you look at the obstacles in front of them, whether it's racism, classism, you know, he overcame so much, you know, and his path was the most dramatic of the three. But even Johnny Weissmuller, who I came into the research of this book thinking, well, here's a very privileged guy, ends up to be Tarzan. He makes millions, where Duke had to struggle through his life in Hollywood trying to find any type of role that were meaningful. And Weissmuller also, as an immigrant to Chicago in the early 1900s, with a father who walked out the door when he was young. He had a surprising number of obstacles himself. And Takeishi, as the Japanese swimmer, he was, nobody knew anything about Japanese swimming and the heritage of that sport in Japan, which was magnificent. So, you know, and he also was looked upon as other, not belonging, not somebody that belonged at the Olympics in 1924. So I think that all three of them really deserve a really close look.
Share with our listeners what you discovered about swimming in Japan.
Well, I mean, I think that I really had no idea when I started to do the research that, you know, it had such heritage. And as I looked into it, it was clear that the samurai history to swimming in Japan, obviously hundreds and hundreds of years of that had gone into innovation and developing strokes for different bodies of water. So this was mainly for warfare purposes, but there was this incredible school of training and teaching. The idea of swimming in the Olympics was not really primary to anything that the Japanese were doing before, you know, early 1900s. But when in the early 1910, 1915, they decided to turn their attention to how do you swim as fast as possible, they quickly turned the page to become rivals in the pool. And, you know, in very short amount of time, they became dominant in the sport. And I think that a lot of people didn't understand how that happened, not really regarding how much glory they had in their past and their culture and how much it was valued. They needed to take a leap from swimming for survival with the natural obstacles in living in an island nation to actually getting in the pool and gaining notoriety and fame for the country.
And what was it about your research with Johnny that maybe surprised you?
Yeah, I think that for Johnny, he was the youngster of them. You know, he was almost half Duke's age, and he was set about really breaking all of Duke records, which doesn't feel like a great thing to be a part of from Duke's perspective. But what I learned about Johnny, which I thought was really interesting, was that he was deeply envious of Duke and his home. He didn't have really a home in Chicago, and even in L.A., it was sort of transient. But Duke had this culture that was so rich and from a family that was extensive and close-knit. And it became pretty clear that Johnny not only wanted the records, he wanted more. He wanted what Duke had in the way of a life. Sadly, he never got to that place. But I think that, you know, it made Johnny more empathetic to me, I think, than I originally had seen him as. The reason I spent a lot of time in Hawaii a couple of years ago was I felt that the legacy of Duke was so terrific and it was very much alive. And I felt like hopefully this book brings a little fuller picture of the other swimmers who also made up this glory in this golden era and extends that somewhat because their legacies haven't really endured the way that Duke's has. So hopefully this makes a difference.
That was a rebroadcast of our interview with Todd Balfe, author of the book Three Kings, Race, Class, and the Barrier-Breaking Rivals Who Redefine Sports and Launch the Modern Olympic Age.
My name is Sophia. I am the digital news editor at Hawaii Public Radio. And a book that I've read this year, actually a series, is Rachel Cusk's three-book series. It starts with Outline and it ends with Kudos, musings on life and how people relate to each other. It's a lot of beautiful English writing if you like that kind of fiction. I love it, so maybe you'll love it too.
Hi, I'm Kyla Herman. I'm the on-air campaign and community of